and bread.
Tomorrow night. With the BBC News. The Israeli Defense Minister has said that Israel will pursue Hezbollah wherever the Iran-backed militant group operates. He was speaking hours after separate Israeli air raids in Lebanon and Syria killed two Hezbollah leaders. David Bamford reports.
Israel's Defense Minister Yoav Gallant warned that Israel will strike at Hezbollah anywhere and everywhere, in Beirut, Damascus and in more distant places. Hours earlier, the Israeli military said it had killed the deputy commander of Hezbollah's rocket unit and seven others east of Tyre in southern Lebanon. Earlier, Hezbollah said its senior commander Ahmed Shahimi was among six fighters killed in an overnight Israeli attack near Aleppo Airport in Syria. 36 Syrian soldiers were also killed, the highest number in a single recent raid. Russia and Iran described the attack on Syria as a violation of international law.
The leader of Northern Ireland's pro-British Democratic Unionist Party, Geoffrey Donaldson, has resigned after being arrested and charged in connection with alleged historical sexual offences. He said he would be strenuously contesting the allegations. A second person, an unnamed woman, has also been arrested on related charges. The Director General of the World Trade Organization has issued a stark warning that moves towards trade protectionism could threaten global growth. Dr. Nkosi Okonjo-Iweala told the BBC she was sounding the alarm about the current trend for countries to reshore their supply chains by encouraging or even forcing companies to move work closer to home. She said this would lead to massive losses in poorer countries.
Fragmented trading world means everyone loses. And if the world fragments into two trading blocks, it could lead to a 5% loss in global GDP in the longer term. For developing countries, it will be double-digit losses. This is nothing that anyone wants to think about.
The South African government has come up with a novel strategy to protect its wildlife. It wants people to eat more of the animals. The Ministry of Environment is aiming to increase its game meat industry sixfold by the year 2036. South Africa's Environment Minister Barbara Creasy told the BBC the plan would help preserve wildlife habitats and bring much-needed income for poorer communities in rural areas.
There are large tracts of land that are marginal from a conventional agricultural point of view. Many of these tracts of land belong either to traditional authorities or to communities. And we believe that if we were to engage in extensive game ranching for purposes of producing game meat from antelope and other forms of plains game.
World News from the BBC. British MPs have warned that food is being used as a weapon of war in the conflict in Sudan. Vicky Ford, the chair of the all-party group on Sudan, said there was evidence both warring parties were restricting humanitarian aid. There have been warnings of famine in Sudan, and more than 20 million people are reported to be in need of food aid. Poland's conservative president Andrzej Duda has vetoed legislation to restore access to the morning after emergency contraceptive pill without a prescription from a doctor. Poland's pro-EU cabinet had approved a draft law to enable women aged 15 and over to get the pill over the counter. Adam Easton reports from Warsaw.
President Duda's veto was expected, but senior female politicians called it harmful and anti-women. A devout Catholic, Mr. Duda is a political ally of the previous Law and Justice government that tightened the law to make the emergency contraceptive pills available only on prescription. Poland is one of just two EU countries that still require a prescription for the medication. The country's new coalition government does not have enough seats in parliament to overturn Mr. Duda's veto.
There's been widespread praise for an eagerly awaited new album by Beyoncé, which challenges preconceptions about country music. Cowboy Carter is the US pop superstar's first foray into the genre. Beyoncé described the album as a deeper dive into the history of country music and our rich musical archive. She said it was driven by not feeling welcome when she began exploring the new sound. Louis Gossett Jr., the first black man to win a supporting actor Oscar, has died in California at the age of 87. He received the Oscar for his portrayal of a no-nonsense drill instructor in the 80s film An Officer and a Gentleman. Gossett also won an Emmy in 1978 for his role in Roots, a groundbreaking TV miniseries about slavery. BBC News.
WORT thanks its listener sponsors and Just Coffee, Madison's Fair Trade Roasting Cooperative. Just Coffee buys fair trade coffee to ensure equitable conditions for coffee grower cooperatives around the world and roasts locally in small batches. More information at 204-9011 or on the web at justcoffee.coop.
WORT thanks its listener sponsors and Five Nines, a locally owned cloud service provider of enterprise-level IT infrastructure consulting, hosting, and management services. On the web at 59s.com. Phone number 512-1000.
6'6" above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take you to another mental level. No power frequency radio.
No change without struggle. No one in power ain't giving up nothing. No change without struggle. No one in power.
WORT 89.9 FM, listener-sponsored community radio, Madison, Wisconsin.
And hello, welcome to A Public Affair. I am Esti Dinur. We have a very, very busy show today. We'll be talking about three of the films that will be presented at the Wisconsin Film Festival. We will give some swag and some tickets. And then at the end, we will be talking about the uninstructed vote that you can take on Tuesday, Election Day. To start with, we'll be talking about a Sudanese film, Goodbye Julia.
أيها الرب الرحوم نضع بين يديك هذا الأرواح
رأيي طلع مجدًا
أبي لقيته
تسمك مين؟ أنا جوليا هيدا دانيال ولدي
صاحب الخادم من الليش
With us is Julia's namesake, Siran Riak. Hello, Siran. Thank you so much for joining us from Dubai.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me.
And I think the movie is really very effective, also very beautifully done, very beautifully acted. I really was glad I got to watch it. Do you want to tell our listeners briefly what it is about? I don't think many of us have seen Sudanese films before, and I think many people don't really know much about Sudan.
That's right. This is one of the first films, Sudanese films, that made it to Cannes Film Festival and won an award. Goodbye Julia is a story that is been happening in Sudan for a very long time. A lot of this, the things that happened in the film, we actually lived it. I personally lived it. It's the story about the separation between Sudan and South Sudan. And the story director Kurdufani was telling is a story of two beautiful women, and he was describing the separation of a relationship between Sudan and South Sudan, the separation between cousins that happened to me because my mom's side was Sudanese and my dad's side was South Sudanese, and I experienced that separation. And he was speaking about the separation of two countries. It's a beautiful written story of Mona, that is Iman, and Julia. Becoming friends after Mona was the reason for the death of Julia's husband. So because she felt guilty, she had to bring in Julia at home, and that's how the story began.
Yeah, and it's a very loaded film. I think it has very important themes, and one of them, I think, is relationships between the powerful and the powerless. And you see it in a variety of different aspects. There's the Sudanese, who are the ones in power against the South Sudanese, who are the ones who are powerless. There's the woman who is powerful and the one who is powerless. And the woman who is powerful is powerless when it comes to her husband. So talk about that, if you will.
That is a reality in Sudan. Women don't have really much of a say at home. This is a traditional house. And also South Sudanese, before the separation, was we were treated like a second-class citizen. In many cases, we didn't have the power to say or the power to do. In most cases, we had second-class jobs, second-class everything in the country.
Yeah, and it's it seems like racism is allowed. I mean, people talk about the South Sudanese as slaves, as dogs. And interestingly enough, there's a discussion between Mona and her husband Akram, in which she tries to get him not to speak that way, but he points to her that maybe she doesn't speak that way, but she behaves that way.
That's right.
talk about that issue of racism in Sudan. I mean, here in the United States, of course, if you're black, most likely you have experienced some racism. There it's an ethnic group against and I don't, you know, throughout the film people say, oh, she's South Sudanese, or they're from South Sudan, right? How do they know? Well,
the story in South Sudan and Sudan is funny because we are all one people, but we are racist to each other, and that is, I think, another dynamic of being racist. This happens in Sudan. I remember the maids or the people who were house helpers working in the house, there was a different kind of plates they use, cups they use. It's marked at the back with usually a nail polish, so we can differentiate, oh, this is for the maids and this is for the house people. We don't share the things. They eat the leftovers of people. It's just they're not treated the same.
Yeah, and another theme that is, actually, before I talk about that, I want to talk about some of the visual part, which is the women are often photographed or cinematographed behind bars of some sort or another, or behind a cage. And also the lighting, the colors inside the houses is dark. Mm-hmm. And then when it comes to the moment of the actual separation, the whole color scheme changes. Suddenly everything is very bright, which again is very interesting. Yeah, I don't know. Do you have something to, you're not the director, but
But in my opinion, that because it was showing Mona was locked. Her opinion was caged. Her thoughts were caged, her dreams were caged. But at that time it was a breaking point for her because she was being set free. But then in the end of Julia, she wasn't set free because that's not what she wanted to do. That's the separation, something that she didn't want. This is just my thoughts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then another theme, I think, is that of forgiveness and reconciliation, where towards the end of the film and towards the separation, there's actually talk about there will be, hopefully there will be forgiveness and reconciliation once we have our own country. But it's also an issue between the two women, isn't it?
Yes, and not everyone got the opportunity to actually speak in a real term in Sudan to their friends from South Sudan, to their colleagues. A lot of people didn't have the opportunity to say goodbye to the Southerners, so yeah.
Yeah. So you said you yourself lived through the cessation, through the separation. At one point, someone there says that We're voting to separate so everyone can be safer. And of course, that is not at all the case. As we know now, we actually are working on a show about Sudan and South Sudan and Darfur, and there's terrible war going on there. Talk about your own personal experience and how you feel. You're in Dubai now, but how do you feel about what's going on in your countries, I suppose, really, right?
Yes, I was born in Sudan and I was raised in Sudan, and I lived all my life in Sudan until the point of separation. It was very difficult to leave because that was home for me. Even the South Sudan side, I've never visited, I've never been. So it was super strange to leave home, being actually kicked out. Because at some point when the period of separation was happening, when we go to school, we get disturbed by the boys in the streets. Like, they stone us in the streets, they yell at us, they fight us, go home to your country, this is what you wanted, so why are you even here? It was a disturbing experience. When we left, we couldn't stay in South Sudan because there was not much to be done at the time, so we had to move to Uganda. But it felt like I lost home, and I still have no home up to now. And whatever is going on right now in Sudan is really disturbing, because I still had family there from my mother's side, and seeing them going through the war and losing a few people that I knew from there is just really heartbreaking. And I don't understand what's going on, and I hope this ends soon, and I really pray that Sudan comes back at some point in life.
Yeah, so the experience of Julia is very similar to your personal experience. Yeah.
Yes.
There's one thing I didn't understand. Maybe you can explain that to me. Why does she say no to the man who loves her and who it seems she loves too? Why won't she go with him?
This was a case for so many South Sudanese. They never wanted to go, because in my case, I never wanted to leave Sudan because this is my home. And I feel like Julia was the same. She didn't want to go. She wanted him, but she wanted him in Sudan. He didn't want the idea of Sudan. He wanted the idea of starting his own new hometown and becoming somebody in his own hometown. And that's something she didn't... She was fighting in her mind, like, oh no, we can still be here, we can still build a home here, but that's something he didn't agree with.
Yeah, yeah. We're almost out of time, so there's two things I want to still say. One is a man made that movie, but it's, I think, a very... It's like he's a woman, right? I think he really understood.
Yes, power for women. That's right.
Yeah. So tell me about the director briefly.
Director Kordofani is an amazing person. He has an eye, a beautiful eye. And I, some of the things he spoke about is that it's inspired by his mother's story, not necessarily the death or anything, but the caging of a woman, how a Sudanese woman is like. This is something he was inspired by from his own home.
Yeah, yeah. It's, I mean, really, as the film went on, I was like, I can't believe a man directed this. So, tell him, if you talk to him, that I was very, very impressed with that. And also, really, the movie is beautiful and touching. There's a child, too, that we didn't talk about. But and there's a touch there about child soldiers, too, which is a very important issue in many parts of the world. But I just want to let people know that I've been talking with Siran Riak, who plays Julia in Goodbye Julia. She's South Sudanese, born and raised in Khartoum. She left Sudan in 2010, after the separation from South Sudan. She was a fashion model for 10 years as the founder and CEO of her own model agency based in Dubai, known as Siran Model Management. She started the agency after receiving numerous rejections trying to pursue modeling in Europe. I can't understand that, Siran. You are very beautiful. But she did that in an effort to give younger women the opportunity to live their modeling dreams in Dubai. Goodbye, Julia is one of her biggest achievements yet, opening bigger doors and opportunities not only for her, but everyone dreaming of becoming an actor in South Sudan. It was your first movie.
That's right.
Yeah, very well done. Thank you so much, Siran. I really appreciate you joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Bye-bye. And I hope many people see that movie. And now, folks, if you want to call when I tell you, 2-5-6-0-8-2-5-6-2-1-1. And if you are the first, when I tell you, don't call yet, you can get some Wisconsin Film Festival swag in partnership with the Wisconsin Film Festival. I'm giving away a gift set to the first person to call the station. Included in the gift is a blanket with a festival logo, a magnet, and a set of pins. Call us right now. Only the first person will get that gift. 608-256-2001. And let's go to our next film.
Over 10 years ago, I started working on Angels of Dirt, a project that opened the door to a community of young female motorcycle racers who inspired me with their grace, their readiness, and their determination to compete. The first racer I met was 9-year-old Charlotte Kings.
My name is Charlotte Evan. I'm 9 years old. I've been racing for 4 years. I've been riding for 5.
That was the beginning of a story of passion and a fearless dedication to sport.
And hello, Wendy Schneider.
Hi.
In the studio with me. That's lovely. Wendy is the director of Angels of Dirt. She's an award-winning independent filmmaker in Madison who has written, directed, and produced feature documentaries on Butch Vig's legendary Smart Studio that was titled The Smart Studio Story and Teen Self-Injury that was cut. Schneider is also an activist, musician, and record producer engineer who brings a DIY ethos and a social consciousness to everything she does. The film we're talking about is Angels of Dirt. So as we just heard, you started working on it 10 years ago.
I did that promo 7 years ago.
Also 17 years ago.
Yes. And I want to say it was nice to hear Charlotte Kane's voice this segment. Thanks for having me, Esther.
Absolutely. It's my pleasure. So what got you 17 years ago to want to make this movie?
Just real curiosity. You know, I'd been to Aztalan a few times, which is in Lake Mills, Wisconsin. You can see the track when you drive to and from Milwaukee. Or on I-94.
And it's a state park, isn't it?
No, it's a racetrack.
Oh, so there's a state park and there's the racetrack.
And, you know, when there was a lot of action on the weekends, it was very alluring, you know, to see. So I went with my friend Shannon a few times as just a spectator, having a blast. And then when I finished my film on teens and self-injury, I still had the camera on loan. So I showed up and just thought I would talk to some of the young girls that were racing. They seemed like a really interesting group of young people to chat with. And it started with Charlotte.
And why? Why Charlotte?
You know, I was on my way there to film the first day of filming, and we stopped. I think a train was passing or something, and there was this guy on a motorcycle. His name was Dave Kilkenny. And I let him know what I was doing, and he said, "You got to meet Charlotte Kanes." And so that's what I did. I just, you know, sought her out, introduced myself to her. I think her mom and dad were both there that afternoon, and asked if she wanted to chat with me about racing motorcycles. And what you heard was, you know, a piece from one of the first interviews that I did with her.
Mm-hmm.
She was 9 at the time.
And you fell in love with her?
Well, that's intense, but I did.
I don't mean it in a romantic sense, of course.
But you know, Charlotte was she was just a sweet young person. That's, you know, she was sweet. She was quiet, but she was cool and engaged with me enough to make me feel
like I wanted to know a little bit more about her. And her father and her mom, they were both incredibly welcoming. The whole community at Aztalan during those years was just so welcoming. I felt like I was allowed back. Like I was, you know, like they kind of let me in, you know, to start talking, you know, with young people.
Well, tell us about the community. I wasn't aware of any of that until I saw the film.
Sure.
I thought, you know, bikers are bikers are bikers, right? Big, hairy guys on big bikes,
scary. I mean, I think that people who are connected with motorcycles are as different as anyone that walks through the doors at WORT. You know, I think that the community at Aztalan is, you know, a pretty, you know, there's two groups of racers at the track at the that are part of the club that is the cycle club there. There are motocross racers and there are flat track racers. Those are the two amateur races that they hold at Aztalan, which is a District 16 track under the umbrella of AMA, which is the American Motorcycle Association. And, you know, I think that my expectations were realistic. I mean, I felt comfortable hanging and talking with people there. They weren't breaking any molds in terms of personalities. I just felt like it was a really nice group of people that were connected to this sport, to flat track.
Yeah, and one thing that comes through is how supportive they are of the youngsters.
Yeah.
Charlotte herself started riding at age 4, it's so cute to see these little kids, including her, with their helmets on these tiny little bikes. And but Charlotte specifically, who really is the star of the film, clearly made very meaningful relationships in that group with other girls and also with adults.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
Which is one of the very interesting parts of the film.
Yeah, I think at one point Dave in the film says, you know, she was like a 15-year-old kid and she had a bunch of like 45-year-old friends.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of... you know, the folks at ASI, you know, in the flat track community, it's really not divided. At that time, it wasn't divided by gender. There were no female-only races. Everybody raced together. It was all about ability. I think now there are some races that are specifically for young girls to help sort of recruit more, you know, more enthusiasts into the sport. But that was also something I was really drawn to. This was... you know, a community and a sort of a race community that did not separate out girls or women. And
yeah.
I really liked that.
Yeah. But the girls do talk about being girls.
And sure.
The women do talk about being women in this sport that is basically, or, you know, was until they came and claimed their place, was a man's world.
Yeah. And every woman or young girl that I would speak to would have their own perspective on that. But, you know, I mean, some would feel, I would say that most of the young women that I talked to and young girls just did not really identify as a female racer. You know, sometimes they were aware that they were a female racer, maybe. I'm not sure. I guess I can't really think about like those examples, but they just identified as racers. And I appreciated that it wasn't like all the, you know, girls over here and the boys over here, or it just was not divided like that. And I think that I was curious about that, which is why I would ask, like, what is it? I think my earlier questions before it became a bit more focused, the film. And of course, you know, in 2016, the film changed quite a bit when we lost Charlotte. But, you know, early on, I was just trying to understand, like, what's it like being a girl racing? And how do you tackle your fears? And they were very basic questions. But, you know, all the girls just felt like racers most of the time.
Yeah. And Charlotte, in the case of Charlotte and in the case of at least one, maybe two others, they actually, you can see how the relationship with her father really influenced them in becoming who they became.
Mm-hmm. I think so. I mean, I think, you know, Charlotte knew racing through her dad, Jack Kanes, as a racer. And, you know, as you learn in the film, you know, she grew up around the track. She grew up around people who raced, but she also grew up around good people who cared about her.
Yeah.
So I think that that's the feeling that would precede, I want to be a racer. It's how do you feel in the environment that you're in? And I think Charlotte felt supported and accepted and encouraged. And she wanted it from a very, very early age. If you, you know, in the film, I include some of her early drawings. They were all motorcycles. Not all of them, but most of them were motorcycles. And, you know, I said to someone recently that, you know, the film is largely about manifesting what you want through focusing on it and embodying it. And Charlotte wanted to be a professional flat track racer. Which
yeah.
is what she became.
Yeah. And like you mentioned, she died doing what she loved. If you want to talk about that, and also, do you know what the rate of casualties is in these sports?
No. I mean, I think that, you know, Charlotte was excelling really well in the sport of flat track. She got her pro license and started doing the circuit of American flat track races around the country in the summer. And her first full season, she was unfortunately involved in there was a crash in front of her. And so she got involved in that crash and as a result lost her life at Santa Rosa when she was racing. It was the last race of her first full pro season. That aspect of the film for me still remains to be very difficult to talk about or to feel. The feelings that are associated with that day are very overwhelming for most of us who are connected to Charlotte. And I think, you know, for that reason, casualties that did not become a branch on the tree of Angels of Dirt. Like, I didn't want to go in that direction. I felt that the life force around Charlotte and around friendship and community and the sport was what I wanted to talk about, what I wanted to share with the stories that I had through filming.
Yeah, and I would like to tell our listeners that... Well, you know, I asked you if you fell in love with her, and you know, maybe it's not the right way to put
everyone
it,
does.
But I
she
did.
Was amazing.
I did.
Yes.
As I was watching the movie, I was
yes.
like, "Wow, what a kid! What a young person! I just loved her." Mm-hmm. And people, bring your Kleenex when you. I cried. I cried at the end, and we talked, and you said that how you still cry.
It's hard not to be emotional around her not being with us, but it's also. You know, part of that is how much love you feel around, how much love that you know is around Charlotte, you know, and she is still very much yeah. a part of people's stories and lives. And, you know, we honor her in many, many different ways. This film is one way of honoring her, or it's a memorial race, or it's a plaque, or it's a tattoo or
yeah.
stickers. I mean, it's she's everywhere.
And there were memorial races all around the country.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, we're out of town, but I do want to say you also composed and played the music in the film, and I understand you'll be back with the real Jaguar to
yes.
play the music.
Yeah, I'll be in this afternoon to play some
okay,
of the music.
Okay, so folks, if you want to hear more, starting at 2:00.
And the Barrymore at 7:00 on April 7th is the premiere of
and
the film.
We have a giveaway.
Oh, yes.
The first two people who will call when I say to call, 608-256-2001, are each going to get a pair of tickets to the showing of Angels of Dirt.
Yes.
608-256-2001. Call now. Thank you so much, Wendy Schneider.
Thank you very much, Esty.
Appreciate you coming in. And let's go to our next film.
To those people that say that climate change is not happening, you got to live here to see it.
It's becoming harder and harder to find the kind of food we need.
I want to be like my brother, and I'm trying to follow his footsteps and keep our culture alive.
And this is from One with a Whale, and with us is Peter Chilkowski. He's co-director of the film. He has spent the last 20 years shooting, producing, and directing long and short form content around the world. Mesmerized by the rich diversity of our planet, he often chooses adventure over comfort, which is the case with this film. The more remote the location, the greater the fulfillment, from the frozen tundra of Alaska up to the peaks of Kyrgyzstan, Tian Shan Mountains, down to the ocean depth of the blue corner of Palau. A multi-award-winning producer and director, his latest project, Life Below Zero, First Alaskans, airs on Nat Geo, the only nonfiction series with an all Native American cast. Pete, thank you so much for joining us today for this film that happens in Gambell, Alaska, population 698 people, settled around 1200 BC. What drew you to make this film?
Well, first of all, thanks for having me. My partner, Jim Wickens, who is an environmental activist, he started the first environmental detective agency. We met on a TV series in the Pacific on a Navy cutter, and we were trying to bust child enslavement as well as people illegal fishing. And we ended up catching a ship in the middle of the Pacific. And unfortunately, there were children on board. So we thought there was going to be enslavement. But we suddenly realized the situation was very different. It was fathers and sons. So we immediately called up the agency, the network, and said, okay, so we got the situation. And they're like, okay, you guys got the bad guys. And we're like, no, these aren't the bad guys. These are fathers and sons. And why are they 1,000 miles at sea to try to provide for their lives? And they were like, nope, you got the bad guys. You guys are the good guys. So being on contract, we couldn't do anything, but we suddenly realized that there was this, you know, entrenched racism in the environmental movement. And we wanted to try to figure out a story to kind of crack that open. And one day, a couple months later, Jim saw this story on Facebook about this youngest kid who ever harvested a whale and how suddenly his success turned into pain and hate, with all these environmental activists attacking him. So we decided, wow, this is a great story. Let's try to follow.
Yeah, and really the history of the environmental movement, at least part of it, has a lot to do with racism, but I know of it happening when national parks were designated, and it was the environmental movement of the time that demanded that the native people who lived there be taken out of there because they were presumably disturbing the environment. So this is yet another such story. Paul Watson is involved. Do you want to remind people who he is and explain his role in this story?
So Agora, Chris, was the youngest kid ever to harvest a whale in his village. He was 16 years old. He lives on an island that has no trees. It's tundra. It's basically covered in ice, and basically all the food you can get comes from the sea and the land, primarily, you know, sea mammals. Their island is closer to Siberia. You can see the Siberian mountains from there than Alaska. And when he harvested this whale, they just got internet. So word spread to all the villages, and everybody was celebrating the successful whale hunt that he did, that's going to provide food for the village of 600 for a couple months, particularly in the winter months where there's not a lot of food. And then suddenly, Paul Watson, who has an organization called, was the founder of Sea Shepherd. He's one of the founders of Greenpeace, but he was too militant for Greenpeace, so they threw him out of Greenpeace. And then he became the head of Sea Shepherd. Most people know him because he was he had a TV show called Whale Wars for years. So him and his followers, they got wind of this, and they started sending this 16-year-old kid thousands of death threats and hate messages. I mean, to attack a kid is horrible enough, especially on an island that has probably the highest rate of teen suicide in the world, but definitely in the United States. And that's the story. That's where we got wind of that. And then we decided to contact them. And it was very interesting because, you know, we called them up. Jim wrote them a long letter on Facebook saying, you know, explaining who he is. He's an environmentalist. He has arrest warrants for anti-whaling in Japan. And we heard nothing for months. And then suddenly one day, my partner lives in Portugal, he got a note saying, hey, sure you can come. Just ask my mom, as if we were just going to, like, go down the street, not like, you know, 2 days of travel, 5,000 miles. And so we contacted the mom. I contacted Akapak Susan and I said, hey, we'd like to make this movie. We're thinking about that. And she was like, sure, come, please. We'd love to have you. And then I asked her, you know, what should we bring? You know, most of my family comes from Europe. I spent a lot of my summer vacations in Poland. We always ask, what do you want? You know, what should we bring? And I was thinking they want some electronics, some Yankees hats. And they were like, bring food. And I was like, huh? And they were like, bring food. So as a New Yorker, I went to Whole Foods and bought up all this great, you know, frozen organic meat and shipped it all the way to, you know, with me to Alaska. I thought I was super prepared. And I met Jim in Nome, and just as we got there, Gambell is probably one of the hardest places to reach, probably the most remote place in the United States. And we got stuck in Nome because the wind was so bad and the weather was so bad. So we waited there for a couple of days. We put our meat into the freezer, and suddenly at 6:30 in the morning, we got a phone call from the airlines: "Come quick! The plane's leaving now. If you want to get on, come, come." So we ran to the airport. Totally unprepared. We got on the flight. Of course, there was no airport. It was just a tarmac. It was minus 20. It was blowing snow. No one met us at the airport. We had no idea where we were going. And of course, the thing we forgot was all the meat in the freezer.
Oi, 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 oi. Because you do show how expensive food is there. I mean, A box of cereal is like $12 and so on and so forth. I'm assuming because it's so remote and it's so hard to get cargo there. But that again is why hunting for wildlife is so very important, and that's what it is. It's simply wildlife. It's like here there is a tradition of hunting deer by people mostly who don't, you know, who are not hungry, though it's also for subsistence. But there we are talking about subsistence, aren't we?
Well, purely. I mean, there is a very big similarity because it's subsistence and it's also tradition. You know, there's about these, you know, thousands-year-old traditions that we continue. And it's very similar in terms of a lot of the hunting communities in America, although they may not be subsistence hunters. You know, a lot of places, you know, in Wisconsin and Michigan actually have, you know, the school, they have a day off for the first day of hunting in school so that the family, the father can take, or the, you know, the elders can take the younger kids out hunting, have a tradition of it, and also, you know, put food in their freezers. But here, basically, if you don't hunt, you die. You can't be a vegan or a vegetarian in Gambell. It's just basically impossible. You need to survive on, you know, walrus, whale, and seal. So it's actually pretty amazing because you're living with a group of people who live in a certain way that the way they lived thousands and thousands of years ago. They literally wake up every morning and they're looking at the wind, at the temperature, at the ice, at the water. Can they go out? They're always thinking about providing, because you don't just provide for yourself, you provide for your family, and you provide for your community. There's a lot of elders that can't go out hunting themselves, who don't have children that provide. So there are designated hunters, providers for the family. And that's what they do. Every day they're going out. And the parallel that I use, and because of that, a lot of the tradition, you know, that lifestyle occupies your identity a lot of times, because that's what you do. That's what you're thinking about, you know, a majority of your time. So in a certain way, this walrus, this whale, is almost like the buffalo of the lower 48. And we see what happens in the lower 48 when that buffalo has been removed. And it decimates not only the subsistence and the food, but it also kills the kind of identity and the kind of mentality and the lifestyle of a group of people who that's what you would do. You would go and provide. So it's intrinsic in so many different ways, not just providing your food, but keeping your culture, your language, and your traditions alive.
Yeah, and you see at the end of the movie when Chris gets another whale, how this is really
a spoiler alert.
Sorry?
Spoiler alert.
Should I not?
It's okay.
I mean, it's not, there's no tension and, you know, waiting for to find the, but anyway, what you see is that it is really a community affair. Everybody, you know, the news spreads immediately and everybody is going out there. There's a whole flotilla that goes out and comes back. There's this celebration. Everybody knows that now there'll be food, not just for Chris, not just for his family. They actually say for the whole island, not just their community. So you see that, and then you also see, besides the Paul Watson and the so-called environmentalists who hate people who still live, you know, in the way that their ancestors lived, you see racism, right? People, I mean, the names that they call Chris and his family are absolutely disgusting. And so you see that, but you also see the effect of climate change and how that really affects their lives. So if you want to talk about that.
Sure, yeah. I mean, climate change is definitely, you know, they're definitely on the forefront of climate change. You know, right now there's just been articles about the polar ice caps melting and it's going to be changing our time clocks. So it's definitely so much, it's climate change is something that they have to deal with every day. The first time we arrived there was in 2018 and there was no ice at all. And this is the first time in known history that there was no ice. Now, why is ice important? Ice, you know, they're in the Bering Sea. So first of all, ice keeps the ocean calmer in those winter months. So you actually go travel by boat. If there's no ice, the waves come higher. They can destroy the village and eliminate the village. The other thing is that all the sea mammals travel with the ice. They migrate with that ice. If you're a walrus, you need a place to rest. So what they do when they hunt, they very often go and look for that ice. You're going out. And there was none. So we actually would get, the first time we went out, we actually went out like, I think 60 miles out to sea. And you're talking about 60 miles on an 18-foot skiff, you know, that's a lake boat. It's good for going, you know, on a small lake. And here we are 60 miles out at sea, finding no ice, finding no mammals. And it was actually a beautiful moment. We had, we traveled so far. Jim had just had heart surgery, so he was basically hypothermic in the back. He was totally not prepared because although there was no ice, it was still minus 20. And I ended up giving him my sweatshirt, and we stopped for a little bit to have some coffee. And one of the guys goes, "Welcome to tomorrow." And I was like, "What?" He goes, "Yeah, welcome to tomorrow." And I was like confused. I don't know if I was like too cold. I didn't really understand what was going on. My brain wasn't functioning. And he goes, "Oh, we just crossed the date line." And I was like, "Oh my God, I can't believe we're like making a science fiction movie. We're going into the future using techniques of yesterday to eat today." So, you know, climate change, unfortunately, is something really that they feel every day. Now they have ice, but they're having bigger winds, so they can't go back out. The ice packs coming in, so they actually get locked in on the island and they can't actually go out on boats anymore. The hunting windows are much smaller. So it's not like, and everyone thinks with climate change originally that it was just going to get hotter and colder. I think it's just that the weather becomes more unpredictable. And that's a difficulty.
Yeah, and dangerous. Well, Pete Cholkowski, the co-director of One with a Whale, which will also be presented as part of the Wisconsin Film Festival. Thank you for the film and thank you for joining us.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me aboard. Cheers.
Bye-bye. And with that, we're ending our segments about the Wisconsin Film Festival, and we are going to be talking for the rest of our show today about the Uninstructed Vote campaign, and with us is Hala Ahmad. She's spokesperson for Listen to Wisconsin. Hello, Hala. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
And good to see you.
Good to see you.
So Listen to Wisconsin, what is that?
So Listen to Wisconsin is a grassroots effort to represent what are, we think, the majority of Wisconsin voters' demands for a ceasefire that's immediate and permanent, and for serious efforts towards peace in Gaza by voting in the Democratic presidential primary for an uninstructed delegation on April 2nd this week.
Yeah, why should people do that?
So I think the main reason that you know, communities across Wisconsin from every faith, every race, every background, every age have been putting out the word to vote uninstructed is that they feel really betrayed by the White House, by the policies that we've been supporting with our tax dollars in Gaza, and grieving every day for months as we witness mass starvation and death and destruction that the U.S. is both politically and financially supported. So we really hope that voting uninstructed on April 2nd can send a really clear message to the administration that it has to change course in order to win voter support in Wisconsin. And that's part of the reason why we're hoping to get 20,000 votes for uninstructed, because that's the margin that President Biden won by in 2020. And we think that this is a really unique opportunity for Wisconsin voters to push for policy change and really push for lives to be saved ultimately.
And the uninstructed campaign here in Wisconsin is joining several other successful campaigns in other states. It started in Michigan, of course. Tell us about the other campaigns that have already happened and what the results have been.
Yeah. So in Minnesota, let me start with Michigan. So in Michigan, which was the first prominent uncommitted vote, where there's a history of using the uncommitted option in the Democratic primary and primaries in general in Michigan to kind of voice dissent that you don't like any of the candidates. But in Michigan, they were able to get 100,000 votes for uncommitted, and they had the same demands that we have, which are, you know, a permanent and immediate ceasefire and ending military aid to Israel and taking really serious steps towards peace, including, full entry of humanitarian aid and ending the siege on Gaza. So they were really successful. And in fact, that was 10 times the amount that Biden won Michigan by in 2020. So Michigan was a landslide. Minnesota was another really big one. I think it was upwards of, I want to say, 40,000 votes. Don't quote me on that.
20-some percent, as I remember.
That's right, yeah. And Washington State also had a large number. Now, we're seeing a lot of numbers in some states. It may not always be, it's not so many that it's a majority of voters who are moving this way, and much less, you know, a majority of voters don't vote in the primary elections usually, but people are turning out in some parts of the state, in different states, to say that they want to end this genocide and what they see as a genocide, what they see as unacceptable violence that the White House has continued to support for over 5 months.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have to ask you the question that everybody else asks you. Doesn't this campaign help Trump? And I'm asking it because, it's no secret that I support the uninstructed campaign, and people have been asking me that. I know that there are people who support this, but who are very, very afraid of Trump becoming basically a dictator of the United States. So what's the answer to that question?
Yeah, I think the communities that are really behind the uninstructed campaign in Wisconsin have been impacted by the Trump administration in negative ways, and even in ways that continued through the Biden administration. And that they share, you know, fear for democracy. And I think that's why they want to use a democratic process, and we want to use a democratic process to say that enough is enough. We need policy change right now, and you cannot, elected leaders cannot be guaranteed the support of the public if the public feels so morally misaligned with their electeds, and they've been calling for months. I mean, really calling, phone calls, emails, protests in the street. And a majority of Americans do support a ceasefire, and we still haven't seen that imposed at all. Instead, you know, we see sort of affectations towards a ceasefire while at the same time approving more weapons and even advanced weapons being transferred to for Israel's war. And most Americans don't want any part of it. So we think that that's the part that's really breaking our democracy, is that the White House can continue to ignore a majority of voters who don't want this war, and they want an end. They want to see an end. They want to see serious steps towards peace.
Yeah. So I don't know what's going on here with the audio. It's better now. Thank you. So again, we have very little time, but like you said, we are seeing Trump and Kamala Harris saying things while doing totally different things. What's your hope of us being able to affect things, and what happens then? What happens after the primary?
Yeah, I mean, the truth is that, you know, Wisconsin voters have a really unique opportunity on April 2nd by voting uninstructed in the Democratic primary specifically to send a message to Biden and Kamala and say, look, this is what you've done so far to talk about, you know, your concern for the humanitarian situation, but not take serious steps to actually end this war is not enough. And it does not align with the will of the voters. And we think that, you know, because of how much pressure there is now internationally with many of our allies pushing for a permanent ceasefire and full humanitarian aid to be entered, you know, Wisconsin voters get to input in this international issue at just the right time. And I think, you know, people can vote however they want in November. But if you believe that the war is immoral because everybody deserves safety and freedom and dignity, and we don't want to see all of this bloodshed, we want viable alternatives and pathways to peace, then you should vote uninstructed on April 2nd in the Democratic presidential primary.
Mm-hmm. And we have very little time left. So let me ask you two questions in one and see what you can do with a minute and a half. One is... why should people care about the, you know, what's going on in Gaza? How does it affect us, right? And the second question is, how can people help if they want to help the campaign in its last few days?
Yeah. You know, I think for a lot of communities in Wisconsin, the war in Gaza is not so far away. We have people right here in Wisconsin, families who've lost innocent loved ones. And at the same time, thousands of American troops have been moved to the region as Israel continues to escalate towards potential regional warfare, which we want no part in and we have not consented to. And on top of that, while families are facing rising prices and we've been hardly able to pass, you know, additional funds for affordable housing or healthcare or paid leave or, you know, student, you know, grants for students to pay for tuition, we see Congress prioritizing billions of dollars in military aid to Israel, and it keeps on going. And, you know, no matter, like I said, no matter what we look like, no matter where you come from, Wisconsinites really believe that everybody deserves safety. Everybody deserves freedom. And
people, if people want to help,
we get to input on that.
If people want to help, what can they do? What should they do?
Oh, yeah. If people want to help, they can go to listentowisconsin.com/volunteer. Super simple, but it's really important that people hear about this campaign. We know that if people hear about it, they support it. And so we need folks at the phones, we need folks at the polls, and you can vote early through Saturday in most precincts, but also vote on April 2nd.
Hala Ahmed, spokesperson for Listen to Wisconsin. Thank you so much for joining us today. Bye-bye. And thanks to Summer and Jade, who also prepared all of our intros, and to Rick, who answered the phones today. I'm Esti Dinor. Talk to you next week. Bye-bye.
WORT, Madison.
I feel good. I knew that I wouldn't. I feel good. I knew that I wouldn't. So good, so good. I got you. Wow, I feel nice. A sugar and spice. I feel nice. A sugar and spice. So nice, so nice. I got you.
Well, good afternoon. Welcome to the Mel and Floyd Summer Replacement Show. I'm Mel. Floyd is on assignment, but with us, as always, the man who knows everything, Mr. Smarty Pants.
Howdy.
Knows everything except how to stay awake today.
I'm a little sleepy today.
You're a little out of it.
Yeah, so
you've been running around all morning.
Yeah, yeah. Went out to IKEA. Saw a giant rabbit there. A guy dressed up in an Easter Bunny costume.
Yeah, was it Sean Spencer?
No. You know, every time I see an Easter Bunny costume, I always think of that. There's no good way that a child can like look at that and not be horrified, right?
Right.
I've yet to figure out why people continue to do this thing with the Easter Bunny, but I am always reminded of once at Hilldale, they had an Easter rabbit, except they tried to make it like non-denominational. It had like a little throne. It just said the bunny on it, like, you know, like, just, for some reason there's a rabbit here. I don't know why, you know, guy dressed up in the rabbit costume,
rabbit formerly known as Bunny.
Yeah, but companion and I were walking by, and there was